Coming to America, 1778. There was a girl, and her uncle sold her, wrote Mr. Ibis in his perfect copperplate handwriting. That is the tale. The rest is detail. There are stories that are true, in which each individual's tale is unique and tragic, and the worst of the tragedy is that we have heard it before, and we cannot allow ourselves to feel it too deeply. We build a shell around it, like an oyster dealing with a painful particle of grit, coating it with smooth pearl layers in order to cope. This is how we walk and talk and function day in, day out, immune to others' pain and loss. If it were to touch us, it would cripple us or make saints of us. But for the most part, it does not touch us. We cannot allow it to. Tonight, as you eat, reflect if you can. There are children starving in the world, starving in numbers larger than the mind can easily hold, up in the big numbers where an error of a million here, a million there, can be forgiven. It may be uncomfortable for you to reflect upon this, or it may not, but still, you will eat. There are accounts which, if we open our hearts to them, will cut us too deeply. Look, here is a good man, good by his own lights and the lights of his friends. He is faithful and true to his wife. He adores and lavishes attention on his little children. He cares about his country. He does his job punctiliously as best he can. So, efficiently and good-naturedly, he exterminates Jews. He appreciates the music that plays in the background to pacify them. He advises the Jews not to forget their identification numbers as they go into the showers. Many people, he tells them, forget their numbers and take the wrong clothes when they come out of the showers. This calms the Jews. There will be life, they assure themselves, after the showers. And they are wrong. Our man supervises the detail taking the bodies to the ovens. And if there is anything he feels bad about, it is that he still allows the gassing of vermin to affect him. Were he a truly good man, he knows, he would feel nothing but joy as the earth is cleansed of its pests. Leave him. He cuts too deep. He is too close to us, and it hurts. There was a girl, and her uncle sold her. But like that, it seems so simple. No man, proclaimed Dunn, is an island. And he was wrong. If we were not islands, we would be lost, drowned in each other's tragedies. We are insulated. A word that means literally, remember, made into an island. From the tragedy of others, by our island nature, and by the repetitive shape and form of the stories. We know the shape, and the shape does not change. There was a human being who was born, lived, and then, by some means or other, died. There. You may fill in the details from your own experience, as unoriginal as any other tale, as unique as any other life. Lives are snowflakes, unique in detail, forming patterns we have seen before, but as like one another as peas in a pod. And have you ever looked at peas in a pod? I mean, really looked at them? There's not a chance you'd mistake one for another after a minute's close inspection. We need individual stories. Without individuals, we see only numbers. 1,000 dead, 100,000 dead. Casualties may rise to 1,000,000. With individual stories, the statistics become people. But even that is a lie. For the people continue to suffer in numbers that themselves are numbing and meaningless. Look. See the child's swollen, swollen belly, and the flies that crawl at the corners of his eyes, his skeletal limbs. Will it make it easier for you to know his name, his age, his dreams, his fears, to see him from the inside? And if it does, are we not doing a disservice to his sister, who lies in the searing dust beside him, a distorted, distended caricature of a human child. And there, if we feel for them, are they now more important to us than 1,000 other children, touched by the same famine, 1,000 other young lives who will soon be food for the fly's own myriad squirming children? We draw our lines around these moments of pain, and remain upon our islands, and they cannot hurt us. They are covered with a smooth, safe, nacreous layer to let them slip, pearl-like, from our souls without real pain. Fiction allows us to slide into these other heads, these other places, and look out through other eyes. And then in the tale, we stop before we die, or we die vicariously and unharmed, and in the world beyond the tale, we turn the page or close the book, and we resume our lives. A life which is like any other, unlike any other. And the simple truth is this. There was a girl, and her uncle sold her. This is what they used to say, where the girl came from. No man may be certain who fathered a child, but the mother, ah, that you could be certain of. Lineage and property was something that moved in the matrilineal line, but power remained in the hands of the men. A man had complete ownership of his sister's children. There was a war in that place, and it was a small war, no more than a skirmish between the men of two rival villages. It was almost an argument. One village won the argument, one village lost it. Life as a commodity, people as possessions. Enslavement had been part of the culture of those parts for thousands of years. The Arab slavers had destroyed the last of the great kingdoms of East Africa, while the West African nations had destroyed each other. There was nothing untoward or unusual about their uncle selling the twins. Although twins were considered magical beings, and their uncle was scared of them, scared enough that he did not tell them that they were to be sold in case they harmed his shadow and killed him. They were 12 years old. She was called Wututu, the messenger bird. He was called Agasu, the name of a dead king. They were healthy children, and, because they were twins, male and female, they were told many things about the gods. And because they were twins, they listened to the things that they were told, and they remembered. Their uncle was a fat and lazy man. If he had owned more cattle, perhaps he would have given up one of his cattle instead of the children. But he did not. He sold the twins. Enough of him. He shall not enter further into this narrative. We follow the twins. They were marched with several other slaves, taken or sold in the war, for 12 miles to a small outpost. Here they were traded, and the twins, along with 13 others, were bought by 6 men with spears and knives who marched them to the west, toward the sea, and then for many miles along the coast. There were 15 slaves now altogether, their hands loosely bound, tied neck to neck. Wututu asked her brother Agasu what would happen to them.
"I do not know," he said.
Agasu was a boy who smiled often. His teeth were white and perfect, and he showed them as he grinned, his happy smiles making Wututu happy in her turn. He was not smiling now. Instead, he tried to show bravery for his sister, his head back and shoulders spread, as proud, as menacing, as comical as a puppy with its hackles raised. The man in the line behind Wututu, his cheeks scarred, said,
"They will sell us to the white devils, who will take us to their home across the water."
"And what will they do to us there?"
demanded Wututu. The man said nothing.
"Well?"
asked Wututu. Agasu tried to dart a glance over his shoulder. They were not allowed to talk or sing as they walked.
"It is possible they will eat us,"
said the man.
"That is what I've been told. That is why they need so many slaves. It is because they are always hungry."
Wututu began to cry as she walked. Agasu said,
Do not cry, my sister. They will not eat you. I shall protect you. Our gods will protect you.
But Watutu continued to cry, walking with a heavy heart, feeling pain and anger and fear as only a child can feel it, raw and overwhelming. She was unable to tell Agasu that she was not worried about the white devils eating her. She would survive. She was certain of it. She cried because she was scared that they would eat her brother, and she was not certain that she could protect him. They reached a trading post, and they were kept there for 10 days. In the morning of the 10th day, they were taken from the hut in which they had been imprisoned. It had become very crowded in the final days, as men arrived from far away, some of them from hundreds of miles, bringing their own strings and skeins of slaves. They were marched to the harbor, and Watutu saw the ship that was to take them away. Her first thought was how big a ship it was. Her second, that it was too small for all of them to fit inside. It sat lightly on the water. The ship's boat came back and forth, ferrying the captives to the ship, where they were manacled and arranged in low decks by sailors, some of whom were brick-red or tan-skinned, with strange pointy noses and beards that made them look like beasts. Several of the sailors looked like her own people, like the men who had marched her to the coast. The men and the women and the children were separated, forced into different areas on the slave deck. There were too many slaves for the ship to hold easily, so another dozen men were chained up on the deck in the open, beneath the places where the crew would sling their hammocks. Watutu was put in with the children, not with the women, and she was not chained, merely locked in. Agasu, her brother, was forced in with the men in chains packed like herrings. It stank under that deck, although the crew had scrubbed it down since their last cargo. It was a stink that had entered the wood, the smell of fear and bile and diarrhea and death, of fever and madness and hate. Watutu sat in the hot hold with the other children. She could feel the children on each side of her sweating. A wave tumbled a small boy into her, hard, and he apologized in a tongue that Watutu did not recognize. She tried to smile at him in the semi-darkness. The ship set sail. Now it rode heavy in the water. Watutu wondered about the place the white men came from, although none of them were truly white. Sea-burned and sunburned they were, and their skins were dark. Were they so short of food that they had to send all the way to her land for people to eat? Or was it that she was to be a delicacy, a rare treat for a people who had eaten so many things that only black-skinned flesh in their cook-pots made their mouths water? On the second day out of port, the ship hit a squall. Not a bad one, but the ship's decks lurched and tumbled, and the smell of vomit joined the mixed smells of urine and liquid feces and fear sweat. Rain poured down on them in bucket loads from the air gratings set in the ceiling of the slave deck. A week into the voyage, and well out of sight of land, the slaves were allowed out of irons. They were warned that any disobedience, any trouble, and they would be punished more than they had ever imagined. In the morning, the captives were fed beans and ship's biscuits, and a mouthful each of vinegared lime juice, harsh enough that their faces would twist, and they would cough and splutter, and some of them would moan and wail as the lime juice was spooned out. They could not spit it out, though. If they were caught spitting or dribbling it out, they were lashed or beaten. The night brought them salted beef. It tasted unpleasant, and there was a rainbow sheen to the grey surface of the meat. That was at the start of the voyage. As the voyage continued, the meat grew worse. When they could, Watutu and Agasu would huddle together, talking of their mother and their home and their playfellows. Sometimes Watutu would tell Agasu the stories their mother had told them, like those of Alegba, the trickiest of the gods, who was Great Mawu's eyes and ears in the world, who took messages to Mawu and brought back Mawu's replies. In the evening, to while away the monotony of the voyage, the sailors would make the slaves sing for them, and dance the dances of their native lands. Wetutu was lucky that she had been put in with the children. The children were packed in tightly and ignored. The women were not always so fortunate. On some slave ships, the female slaves were raped repeatedly and continually by the crew, simply as an unspoken perquisite of the voyage. This was not one of those ships, which is not to say that there were no rapes. 100 men, women, and children died on that voyage and were dropped over the side. And some of the captives who were dropped over the side had not yet died, but the green chill of the ocean cooled their final fever, and they went down flailing, choking, lost. Wetutu and Agassi were traveling on a Dutch ship, but they did not know this, and it might as easily have been British, or Portuguese, or Spanish, or French. The black crewmen on the ship, their skins even darker than Watutu's, told the captives where to go, what to do, when to dance. One morning Wetutu caught one of the black guards staring at her. When she was eating, the man came over to her and stared down at her without saying anything.
Why do you do this? Why do you serve the white devils?
He grinned at her as if her question was the funniest thing he ever had heard. Then he leaned over, so his lips were almost brushing her ears, so his hot breath on her ear made her suddenly feel sick.
If you were older, I would make you scream with happiness from my penis. Perhaps I will do it tonight. I have seen how well you dance.
She looked at him with her nut-brown eyes, and she said, unflinching, smiling even,
If you put it in me down there, I will bite it off with my teeth down there. I am a witch girl, and I have very sharp teeth down there.
She took pleasure in watching his expression change. He said nothing and walked away. The words had come out of her mouth, but they had not been her words. She had not thought them or made them. No, she realized, those were the words of Elegba the trickster. Mawu had made the world, and then, thanks to Elegba's trickery, had lost interest in it. It was Elegba of the clever ways and the iron-hard erection who had spoken through her, who had ridden her for a moment. And that night before she slept, she gave thanks to Elegba. Several of the captives refused to eat. They were whipped until they put food into their mouths and swallowed, although the whipping was severe enough that 2 men died of it. Still, no one else on the ship tried to starve themselves to freedom. A man and a woman tried to kill themselves by leaping over the side. The woman succeeded. The man was rescued, and he was tied to the mast and lashed for the better part of a day until his back ran with blood, and he was left there as the day became night. He was given no food to eat, and nothing to drink but his own piss. By the 3rd day he was raving, and his head had swollen and grown soft, like an old melon. When he stopped raving, they threw him over the side. Also, for 5 days following the escape attempt, the captives were returned to their manacles and chains. It was a long journey, and a bad one for the captives. And it was not pleasant for the crew, although they had learned to harden their hearts to the business and pretended to themselves that they were no more than farmers, taking their livestock to the market. They made harbor on a pleasant balmy day in Bridgetown, Barbados, and the captives were carried from the ship to the shore in low boats sent out from the dock and taken to the market square, where they were, by dint of a certain amount of shouting and blows from cudgels, arranged into lines. A whistle blew, and the market square filled with men, poking, prodding, red-faced men, shouting, inspecting, calling, appraising, grumbling. Wetutu and Agassi were separated then. It happened so fast. A big man forced open Agassu's mouth, looked at his teeth, felt his arm muscles, nodded, and 2 other men hauled Agassu away. He did not fight them. He looked at Wetutu and called, Be brave, to her. She nodded, and then her vision smeared and blurred with tears, and she wailed. Together, they were twins, magical, powerful. Apart, they were two children in pain. She never saw him again but once, and never in life. This is what happened to Agasu. First, they took him to a seasoning farm, where they whipped him daily for the things he did and didn't do. They taught him a smattering of English, and they gave him the name of Inky Jack for the darkness of his skin. When he ran away, they hunted him down with dogs and brought him back and cut off a toe with a chisel to teach him a lesson he would not forget. He would have starved himself to death, but when he refused to eat, his front teeth were broken and thin gruel was forced into his mouth until he had no choice but to swallow or to choke. Even in those times, they preferred slaves born into captivity to those brought over from Africa. The freeborn slaves tried to run, or they tried to die. And either way, there went the profits. When Inky Jack was 16, he was sold with several other slaves to a sugar plantation on Saint-Domingue. They called him Hyacinthe, the big, broken-toothed slave. He met an old woman from his own village on that plantation. She had been a house slave before her fingers became too gnarled and arthritic, who told him that the whites intentionally split up captives from the same towns and villages and regions to avoid insurrection and revolts. They did not like it when slaves spoke to each other in their own languages. Hyacinthe learned some French and was taught a few of the teachings of the Catholic Church. Each day he cut sugar cane from well before the sun rose until after the sun had set. He fathered several children. He went with the other slaves in the small hours of the night to the woods, although it was forbidden, to dance the kalinda, to sing to Dambalawedo, the serpent god, in the form of a black snake. He sang to Alegba, to Ogu, Shango, Zaka, and to many others, all the gods the captives had brought with them to the island, brought in their minds and their secret hearts. The slaves on the sugar plantations of Saint-Domingue rarely lived more than a decade. The free time they were given, 2 hours in the heat of noon, and 5 hours in the dark of the night, from 11 until 4, was also the only time they had to grow and tend to the food they would eat. For they were not fed by their masters, merely given small plots of land to cultivate, with which to feed themselves. And it was also the time they had to sleep and to dream. Even so, they would take that time, and they would gather and dance and sing and worship. The soil of Saint-Domingue was a fertile soil, and the gods of Dahomey and the Congo and the Niger put down thick roots there and grew lush and huge and deep. And they promised freedom to those who worshipped them at night in the groves. Hyacinthe was 25 years of age when a spider bit the back of his right hand. The bite became infected, and the flesh on the back of his hand was necrotic. Soon enough, his whole arm was swollen and purple, and the hand stank. It throbbed, and it burned. They gave him crude rum to drink, and they heated the blade of a machete in the fire until it glowed red and white. They cut his arm off at the shoulder with a saw, and they cauterized it with the burning blade. He lay in a fever for a week. Then he returned to work. The one-armed slave called Hyacinthe took part in the slave revolt of 1791. Elegba himself took possession of Hyacinthe in the grove, riding him as a white man rode a horse, and spoke through him. He remembered little of what was said, but the others who were with him told him that he had promised them freedom from their captivity. He remembered only his erection, rod-like and painful, and raising both hands, the one he had and the one he no longer possessed, to the moon. A pig was killed, and the men and the women of that plantation drank the hot blood of the pig, pledging themselves and binding themselves into a brotherhood. They swore that they were an army of freedom, pledged themselves once more to the gods of all the lands from which they had been dragged as plunder. If we die in battle with the whites, they told each other, we will be reborn in Africa, in our homes, in our own tribes. There was another Hyacinth in the uprising, so they now called Agasu by the name of Big One Arm. He fought, he worshipped, he sacrificed, he planned. He saw his friends and his lovers killed, and he kept fighting. They fought for 12 years, a maddening, bloody struggle with the plantation owners, with the troops brought over from France. They fought and they kept fighting, and impossibly, they won. On January the 1st, 1804, the independence of Saint-Domingue, soon to be known to the world as the Republic of Haiti, was declared. Big One Arm did not live to see it. He had died in August 1802, bayoneted by a French soldier. At the precise moment of the death of Big One Arm, who had once been called Hyacinthe, and before that Inky Jack, and who was forever in his heart Agasu, his sister, whom he had known as Watutu, who had been called Mary on her first plantation in the Carolinas, and Daisy when she had become a house slave, and Suki when she was sold to the Levere family down the river in New Orleans, felt the cold bayonet slide between her ribs and started to scream and weep uncontrollably. Her twin daughters woke and began to howl. They were cream and coffee-colored, her new babies, not like the black children she had borne when she was on the plantation, and little more than a girl herself, children she had not seen since they were 15 and 10 years old. The middle girl had been dead for a year when she was sold away from them. Suki had been whipped many times since she had come ashore. Once salt had been rubbed into the wounds. On another occasion she had been whipped so hard and for so long that she could not sit or allow anything to touch her back for several days. She had been raped several times when younger, by black men who had been ordered to share her wooden pallet, and by white men. She had been chained. She had not wept then, though. Since her brother had been taken from her, she had only wept once. It was in North Carolina, when she had seen the food for the slave children and the dogs poured into the same trough, and she had seen her little children scrabbling with the dogs for the scraps. She saw that happen one day, and she'd seen it before, every day, on that plantation, and she would see it again many times before she left. She saw it that one day, and it broke her heart. She had been beautiful for a while, and the years of pain had taken their toll, and she was no longer beautiful. Her face was lined, and there was too much pain in those brown eyes. 11 years earlier, when she was 25, her right arm had withered. None of the white folk had known what to make of it. The flesh seemed to melt from the bones, and now her right arm hung by her side, little more than a skeletal arm covered in skin and almost immobile. After this, she had become a house slave. The Casterton family, who had owned the plantation, were impressed by her cooking and house skills, but Mrs. Casterton found the withered arm unsettling, and so she was sold to the Levere family, who were out for a year from Louisiana. Monsieur Levere was a fat, cheerful man who was in need of a cook and a maid of all work, and who was not in the slightest repulsed by the slave Daisy's withered arm. When a year later they returned to Louisiana, slave Suki went with them. In New Orleans, the women came to her, and the men also, to buy cures and love charms and little fetishes. Black folks, yes, of course, but white folks too. The Levere family turned a blind eye to it. Perhaps they enjoyed the prestige of having a slave who was feared and respected. They would not, however, sell her her freedom. Suki went into the bayou late at night, and she danced the kalinda and the bambula, like the dancers of Saint-Domingue and the dancers of her native land. The dancers in the bayou had a black snake as their voodoo. Even so, the gods of her homeland and of the other African nations did not possess her people as they had possessed her brother and the folk of Saint-Domingue. she would still invoke them and call their names to beg them for favors. She listened when the white folk spoke of the revolt in San Domingo, as they called it, and how it was doomed to fail. Think of it, a cannibal land! And then she observed that they no longer spoke of it. Soon it seemed to her that they pretended that there never had been a place called St. Domingo. And as for Haiti, the word was never mentioned. It was as if the whole American nation had decided that they could, by an effort of belief, command a good-sized Caribbean island to no longer exist merely by willing it so. A generation of La Vere children grew up under Suki's watchful eye. The youngest, unable to say Suki as a child, had called her Mama Zuzu, and the name had stuck. Now the year was 1821, and Suki was in her mid-50s. She looked much older. She knew more of the secrets than old Sanite Dede, who sold candies in front of the Cabildo, more than Marie Salope, who called herself the Voodoo Queen. Both were free women of color, while Mama Zuzu was a slave, and would die a slave, or so her master had said. The young woman who came to her to find what had happened to her husband styled herself the Widow Perry. She was high-breasted and young and proud. She had African blood in her, and European blood, and Indian blood. Her skin was reddish, her hair was a gleaming black, her eyes were black and haughty. Her husband, Jacques Parry, was, perhaps, dead. He was three-quarters white, as these things were calculated, and the bastard of a once-proud family, one of the many immigrants who had fled from St. Domingo, and as free-born as his striking young wife.
"My Jacques, is he dead?"
asked the Widow Parry. She was a hairdresser who went from home to home, arranging the coiffures of the elegant ladies of New Orleans before their demanding social engagements. Mama Zuzu consulted the bones, then shook her head.
"He is with a white woman somewhere north of here. A white woman with golden hair. He is alive."
This was not magic. It was common knowledge in New Orleans just with whom Jacques Parry had run off, and the color of her hair. Mama Zuzu was surprised to realize that the Widow Parry did not already know that Jacques was sticking his quadroon little peepee into a pink-skinned girl up in Colfax every night. While on the nights that he was not so drunk he could use it for nothing better than pissing, perhaps she did know. Perhaps she had another reason for coming. The Widow Parry came to see the old slave woman one or two times a week. After a month, she brought gifts for the old woman, hair ribbons, and a seed cake, and a black rooster.
"Mama Zuzu,"
said the girl,
"it is time for you to teach me what you know."
"Yes,"
said Mama Zuzu, who knew which way the wind blew. And besides, the Widow Parry had confessed that she had been born with webbed toes, which meant that she was a twin, and she had killed her twin in the womb. What choice did Mama Zuzu have? She taught the girl that two nutmegs hung upon a string around the neck until the string breaks will cure heart murmurs, while a pigeon that has never flown, cut open and laid on the patient's head, will draw a fever. She showed her how to make a wishing bag, a small leather bag containing 13 pennies, 9 cotton seeds, and the bristles of a black hog, and how to rub the bag to make wishes come true. The Widow Parry learned everything that Mama Zuzu told her. She had no real interest in the gods, though. Not really. Her interests were in the practicalities. She was delighted to learn that if you dip a live frog in honey and place it in an ant's nest, then, when the bones are cleaned and white, a close examination will reveal a flat, heart-shaped bone, and another with a hook in it. The bone with the hook on it must be hooked onto the garment of the one you wish to love you, while the heart-shaped bone must be kept safely, for if it is lost, your loved one will turn on you like an angry dog. Infallibly, if you do this, the one you love will be yours. She learned that dried snake powder, placed in the face powder of an enemy, will produce blindness, and that an enemy can be made to drown herself by taking a piece of her underwear, turning it inside out, and burying it at midnight under a brick. Mama Zuzu showed the Widow Peri the World Wonder Root, the Great and Little Roots of John the Conqueror. She showed her Dragon's Blood and Valerian and Five Finger Grass. She showed her how to brew Waste Away Tea and Follow Me Water and Fair Shingo Water. All these things and more Mama Zuzu showed the Widow Peri. Still, it was disappointing for the old woman. She did her best to teach her the hidden truths, the deep knowledge, to tell her of Elegba, of Mawu, of Aido Huedo, the Voodoo Serpent, and the rest, but the Widow Peri, I shall now tell you the name she was born with, and the name she later made famous. It was Marie Laveau. But this was not the great Marie Laveau, the one you have heard of. This was her mother, who eventually became the Widow Glapion. She had no interest in the gods of the distant land. If Saint Domingo had been a lush black earth for the African gods to grow in, this land, with its corn and its melons, its crawfish and its cotton, was barren and infertile.
She does not want to know,
complained Mama Zuzu to Clémentine, her confidant, who took in the washing for many of the houses in that district, washing their curtains and coverlets. Clémentine had a blossom of burns on her cheek, and one of her children had been scalded to death when a copper overturned.
Then do not teach her,
says Clémentine.
I teach her, but she does not see what is valuable. All she sees is what she can do with it. I give her diamonds, but she cares only for pretty glass. I give her a demi-bouteille of the best claret, and she drinks river water. I give her quail, and she wishes to eat only rat.
Then why do you persist?
Mama Zuzu shrugs her thin shoulders, causing her withered arm to shake. She cannot answer. She could say that she teaches because she is grateful to be alive. And she is. She has seen too many die. She could say that she dreams that one day the slaves will rise as they rose and were defeated in La Place, but that she knows in her heart that without the gods of Africa, they will never overcome their white captors, will never return to their homelands. When she woke that terrible night, almost 20 years earlier, and felt the cold steel between her ribs, that was when Mama Zuzu's life had ended. Now she was someone who did not live, who simply hated. If you asked her about the hate, she would have been unable to tell you about a 12-year-old girl on a stinking ship. That had scabbed over in her mind. There had been too many whippings and beatings, too many nights in manacles, too many partings, too much pain. She could have told you about her son, though, and how his thumb had been cut off when their master discovered the boy was able to read and to write. She could have told you of her daughter, 12 years old and already 8 months pregnant by an overseer, and how they dug a hole in the red earth to take her daughter's pregnant belly, and then they whipped her until her back had bled. Despite the carefully dug hole, her daughter had lost her baby and her life on a Sunday morning when all the white folks were in church. Too much pain.
Worship them,
Mama Zuzu told the young Widow Peri in the bayou, 1 hour after midnight. They were both naked to the waist, sweating in the humid night, their skins given accents by the white moonlight. The Widow Peri's husband, Jacques, whose own death, 3 years later, would have several remarkable features, had told Marie a little about the gods of Saint Domingo, but she did not care. Power came from the rituals, not from the gods. Together, Mama Zuzu and the Widow Peri crooned and stamped and keened in the swamp. They were singing in the black snakes, the free woman of color, and the slave woman with the withered arm.
There is more to it than just you prosper, your enemies fail,
said Mama Zuzu. Many of the words of the ceremonies, words she knew once, words her brother had also known, these words had fled from her memory. She told pretty Marie Laveau that the words did not matter, only the tunes and the beats, and there, singing and tapping in the black snakes in the swamp. She has an odd vision. She sees the beats of the songs, the Kalinda beat, the Bambula beat, all the rhythms of equatorial Africa spreading slowly across this midnight land until the whole country shivers and swings to the beats of the old gods whose realms she had left. And even that, she understands somehow, in the swamp, even that will not be enough. She turns to pretty Marie and sees herself through Marie's eyes, a black-skinned old woman, her face lined, her bony arm hanging limply by her side, her eyes the eyes of one who has seen her children fight in the trough for food from the dogs. She saw herself, and she knew then for the first time the revulsion and the fear the younger woman had for her. Then she laughed and crouched and picked up in her good hand a black snake as tall as a sapling and as thick as a ship's rope.
"Here,"
she said.
"Here will be our voodoo."
She dropped the unresisting snake into a basket that Yellow Marie was carrying. And then, in the moonlight, the second sight possessed her for a final time, and she saw her brother Agasu, not the 12-year-old boy she had last seen in the Bridgetown market so long ago, but a huge man, bald and grinning with broken teeth, his back lined with deep scars. In one hand he held a machete knife. His right arm was barely a stump. She reached out her own good left hand.
Stay a while,
she whispered.
I will be there. I will be with you soon.
And Marie Paris thought the old woman was speaking to her.